Our first message, we talked about the big picture. 3,600,000,000 beings. We looked at the kingdom of God and the church and boiled it down to the key being the individual, and that individual being a very special breed of cat, a disciple who knows how to put life on life. And what I'd like to spend my time on in this last session is to try to give you more help on how to operate life on life. And I've titled this message, How to Give Away Your Life. And I'll give you the outline right now because then I can go on and ramble. The first, I have four guidelines to fruitfulness. Four guidelines to how to give away your life. First one is let him into your life. Let him in. Talking about the non-Christian. We're letting the non-Christian into our lives. The second one is accept him as he is. And the third one, feed him well. And then the fourth point, stick with him. Don't give up. Well, let's go back to the first one. Let him into your life. You know, we all have contact with lots of people every day. You get up in the morning and you get into your car and you head for work and you look at the gas gauge and it's low and you stop at a gas station. And a person comes out and waits on you, gasses up your car. You've had contact with a person. And you go on, you get downtown, you haven't had breakfast, and so you go into a restaurant, and a waitress waits on you, and you eat breakfast, and you say hello to a couple of acquaintances as they go by, and then you drive on in, and you put your car in a garage, and or a parking lot, and an attendant helps you with your car. And you go into your office and you are interacting with people all day long. You're passing papers there and they're passing papers your way. And so you have contact with people all day long. But you know, most of those contacts with people are not really contacts with people. They're sort of mechanical contacts with objects. And many times we treat people like objects rather than like human beings. Now, often that has to happen. You couldn't relate to every person you met. You'd go crazy. But in a lot of the contacts that we have with people every day, those people could be mechanisms, machines. And it really wouldn't make a whole lot of difference. The gas station attendant was a gas pumper. Now, if we could come up with a machine that could pump our gas without having a person involved, we really wouldn't notice the difference. We'd get our gas and be on our way. And there are automatic disposals dispensers is the word, for food. You don't need a waitress always. You can get along without that. You're interested in just getting the food on your plate, not necessarily being waited on. And you'd probably get along just fine without the attendant in the parking lot. And even your relationship with the people in the office, it's a mechanical relationship and you're not really relating as people. Now, there's nothing really wrong with that, except that we often treat people like objects at the wrong time in the wrong place. It happens in the home all the time. I can treat my wife like a meal server and a clean shirt dispenser, and she could treat me like a money dispenser and a garbage disposer and a child spanker. And we can live under the same roof day after day and really treat each other as just one more household convenience. We're not really relating as people. We're just there under the same roof, two human beings treating the other one as an object or as a mechanism. Well, that's not right in the home, is it? But you know, it also happens in the Christian ministry. In business, your criteria for success and the way that you measure how you're doing is your balance sheet and whether you use red ink or black ink when you write the final figure. And so you measure your success by how much money you make. Well, in the Christian ministry, how do you measure your success? What is the measurement? Human beings. And so we say, all right, we want everybody out tonight. Why? It may be the last thing some of those people need is one more meeting. Maybe the most spiritual thing he could do is just go to bed that night. Or maybe he's long overdue for a real conversation with his wife. Or maybe he's on the verge of being charged with child neglect. But he has to be at that meeting. Why? For whose benefit? Well, you know, that's diabolical. Because it's all right to manipulate inanimate objects, but when you begin to manipulate people so that you can feel successful, then you're in. Then you have problems. Well, we navigators, we think we're above that because we work with individuals and we evaluate the individual. But you know, in retrospect, as I look at my early years, when I began to talk to people about Christ and witness to people and work with people, you know what I was interested in? I was interested in being successful. And so I would come home in the evening, and I'd say, real cool, like, a witness today. And someone would say, oh, yeah? How'd you do that? Oh, it was nothing. Or some days I could come home and I'd say, super cool, like, led God to Christ today. And that would really bring the house down. Well, it didn't really matter whether the guy understood a word I said or whether he flamed out the next day or what happened to him. I had gotten my reward. I gotten what I was after. One more hash mark. See, I was treating people as means to my success. How do we get away from that? How do we stop treating people, manipulating people, and begin to give them a larger slice, begin to give them our lives? Look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 1. Verse 5, other verses in 1 Thessalonians also that I'll call your attention to. But 1 Thessalonians 1:5, our gospel did not come to you in word only. We didn't just preach at you a little bit. But also in power and in the Holy Spirit and with full conviction, just as you know what kind of men we proved to be among you for your sake. In other words, we exposed ourselves to you. We not only let you know what we knew, but we let you in. We let you see what makes us tick. And we also let you know how we feel. And in chapter 2, he goes on in the same vein. Verse 8, having thus a fond affection for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel, not just give you the message, but also our own lives, because you had become very dear to us. Verse 11, just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children. And so, these men, as they came to that city, were not interested in their careers. They were interested in those people. And the way that they achieved their desires to really reach these people was give them more than just the message. They gave them their lives. They let people in. They were transparent. I have a missionary friend who was trained by the Hitler Youth. And stoicism there is a virtue. And his wife of 12 years told me, you know, I have never heard my husband admit that he is hungry or tired or doesn't feel well. That's unreal. And you know, that guy went to me and asked me for some help in making disciples. Wanted to know how to do it. And when I discovered that about him, I just thought, no way. Impossible. I just forgot it. Didn't even try with him. Because if you do not open your life to the person that you are trying to minister to, you are not going to minister to him. You know, not too long ago, it dawned on me that when I have an appointment with a person, and it's coming up in a couple of hours, you know what I feel? This really frightened me. You know what I feel? I hope he doesn't show. And I thought, good night. How can it be that I hope he doesn't show? That's what I'm giving my life to. But then I noticed that when he doesn't show, I'm sick. And when he does show, the first 5 minutes are tough going. From then on, it's just sheer joy. And I'm blessed. But then I reflected on that, and I think that that may be the way it just got to be. Because in John 12:24, it says, except the corn of wheat fall on the ground and die, it abides alone. And the thing that I fear and the thing that I shrink from in spending time with people is that I know that my life is going to be out there. And it costs you emotionally. And one reason why we are so professional in our ministry is that we're not willing to pay the emotional price that it requires. It's a lot easier to set up a program. It takes less for me to stand here and talk to you than it does for me to spend time rapping with one of you alone. Because I'm giving less right now than I do when I give to an individual. You want to learn how to get into this? Let me just give you a suggestion. It's superficial, but it's a way to start. Most conversations, even though they may be brilliant conversations and witty and so on, are very impersonal. We talk about a football game. We talk about a book we've read. We talk about a political situation. We talk about something that we've learned. But there's no personal commitment in that kind of conversation. Try it sometime. All of a sudden, in the midst of a conversation like that, begin to describe not what you think, but how you feel about that thing. Move from the level of concept to the level of feeling. And see what happens. Begin to take an interest in how people feel. As you sit and listen to someone, think, I wonder how he's feeling. And bring it out. A person is talking about something and you say, well, boy, I imagine that, you know, you really feel good about that. That you really feel that God used you there and that you were successful there. And see his response. He'll respond to you on the same level. Or someone comes along and he has a problem and you say, well, boy, you know, that must really get through to you. You must really feel discouraged with that. Do you feel discouraged about that? Well, you know, as a matter of fact, no, I just feel... And then he begins to talk about how he feels. And I think that what we need to begin to do when we're thinking about letting people into our lives and really ministering to people, giving away our lives, is always try to read how a person is feeling. Not try to second guess him, how he's thinking, but how he's feeling. So that's the first point. The second one, accept him as he is. 1 Corinthians 9:19-23 is the passage we're going to use. And I would say that this passage, 1 Corinthians 9:19-23, I don't hear any pages rustling. I'd like to have you look this up. 1 Corinthians 9:19-23. I would say that this passage is the key passage in this whole subject that we're talking about, getting through to people. And if you have not heard anything I have said until now, listen now, please. Because this is, if there is such a thing as the key to ministering to people, this is it. 1 Corinthians 9:19-23. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all that I might win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews, to those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I may by all means save some. And I do all things for the sake of the gospel. One of the reasons we have so much trouble in relating to the non-Christian, communicating with them, is that they usually feel censured in our presence. They don't want to get close because they feel that they are going to fall into the hands of a reformer. And we are going to set about to remake them. They feel judged. We don't say it. But somehow or other, they know that we disapprove of what they eat and drink. They know that we disapprove of how they spend their time and how they spend their money, what he smells and what he thinks. They know that they picked that up. And they don't like to be around us. And it's funny, you know, I think that what we do is they do offend us. And we subconsciously try to think that if I could just make this guy a little bit better, it would be easier for me to work with him, and my friends wouldn't think I'd be running in such bad company. You know, when you really begin to give your life to pagans, to Gentiles who are out there, you know, you're going to be marginalized by your Christian brothers. They're going to criticize you for the company you keep and the things you do with them. And what it boils down to me is that we have to decide when we are with a person who is truly non-Christian, which of the two of us is going to be comfortable? Him or me? Both can't. One of them gets the nod. My father is a Christian, and a very outstanding Christian, and I am indebted to him for what he gave me. He came down to visit us in Brazil about a year and a half ago and spent a month with us. And it was really a great experience. And I took Dad around to meet some of the guys. Some of the guys came over to meet Dad. He went to the office of some of them to meet them. And after meeting four or five of the guys, he came away from one encounter, which was especially impressive. He had tears in his eyes. And he says, man, he says, I've never met Christians like this in my life. How do you get them to grow like that? Well, how do you answer a question like that? So I just says, well, we just kind of work with them a little bit. Well, he began to watch to see how we got them to grow like that. And he didn't see anything he could recognize. We'd get together with a few guys once in a while. It was December, and I'd kind of cut back because the parents were there and so on. But I'd take my Bible once in a while and shove off and go spend some time with a guy, and I'd come back with the Bible a little bit later. we'd have a barbecue and backyard would be full of people and we'd be eating and having a ball, and then they'd take off, and not even a prayer to sanctify it. He'd watch that go by and think, what was that all about? And one day he came up to me and he said, don't you have regular meetings? No. Well, don't they congregate? No, not regularly. Sometimes we get together. Well, he was totally, you know, it just blew his mind. Because here was the result, which he could not deny. But he saw no correlation with what we were doing, with what was happening. Well, then one of our guys got married, Fernando Gonzalez. And he married a gal out of the German Lutheran culture. And there they have churches down in the southern part there in Brazil. The German Lutheran is a big, you know, Gothic church where she got married. And, had aisle right down the middle like most churches do, and pews, and ferns along the aisle for the wedding, and some flowers up in front. And there were bridesmaids up there, and what is it, best men on the other side. And there was a preacher up there with a robe and a black robe and a white collar and a book out in front. And just, you know, like they do any place. And they sang a couple of hymns there at that wedding. I forget what one of them was, but the other one was How Great Thou Art. Of course, they sang it in Portuguese. Well, my dad came out of the wedding, and I was standing there, and he says, boy, he said, that really spoke to me. I said, what spoke to you? He says, well, those hymns. Well, you hadn't understood a word that they sang. You're just the melodies. Well, then it dawned on me what was going on. See, there's a fine line between homesickness and a spiritual experience. They're both emotional in content. And a missionary comes down to a country. He's the first one there. Sunday morning rolls around. There's no church to go to. He feels like a pagan. Because his props are gone. Because all of his life, he had been propped up by the system of his church, his Sunday school, the hymns, and all these things. These are religious traditions, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when you go to another country, and you leave that behind, those things which made you feel like a Christian are no longer there. And you begin to even have a guilty conscience about how non-religious you suddenly become. And so what do? You begin to reconstruct those things which made you feel good. You get your hymns translated. You begin to get some people together. You form a Sunday school. And then finally you build a building. And you get them all in there. And I had one missionary say, now we have a Sunday school superintendent just like they do in the States. Well, I asked the question, Sunday school superintendent, where did they get the idea of Sunday school, for crying out loud? That's a recent innovation in Christianity. And for the first years that Sunday school was in existence, no self-respecting Christian would think about sending his child to Sunday school, because that would be an admission of failure of their responsibility at home. But these things have become sacred, and we think that they're integral to our Christianity. And what happens is that the missionary gets this all put together. He has his church, he has his pews, he has his people, he has his hymns, and they have their order of service, and he feels comfortable. He feels like a Christian again. But he's the only one in the crowd that feels comfortable. He has chosen which of the two are going to be comfortable. And the result is, any missionary has enough pizzazz to put a group together. And you can get a congregation of 100, 200 people, you know, like that. It doesn't take very long. But the problem is, you produce a sterile Christianity. The people can't sell it. You've established a beachhead, but the people have no arms to carry it on into the world. And you might just as well not have done it. When we're with a non-Christian, there's only one point that we should be interested in changing. Everything else is symptoms. There's only one thing we want to see change, and that's his heart toward God. We bring a person to relate himself to God, and from there on out, God will help him put it together. But that's where it starts. And if we start to make changes, external changes, reformations, before that takes place, we're just wasting our time. Because the problems of man are bound up in his nature. It's like putting a Band-Aid on a smallpox sore. That's not the problem. Okay. Third point is feed him well. I'd like to show you a passage of Scripture in John chapter 4, which has really impressed me. John chapter 4, verses 38 and, let's see, 37 and 38. Jesus is talking to the 12 here, and he had just spoken to the woman, Samaritan woman. And then here he says, for this cause, the saying is true. In this case, the saying is true. One sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap for which you have not labored. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor. I see two things in this passage, which is key to the thing we're talking about. The first one is this. Evangelism is always a process. It is never an event. And so often, when we witness to a person, we treat him as if he were, at that point in time, the sum total of everything he ever was and ever will be. And the way he responds at that time determines his destiny. And if you witness to a person and he responds to Christ, what you can assume is that you have gotten into the tail end of a process that God has been carrying on for years in that person's life, and he has given you the privilege of reaping where you have not sown. But what we need to understand is that anyone we come in contact with is someplace in that process. Maybe there's been no planting, and it'll take months for the harvest to come. Maybe there's been planting but no watering, and it will take months for the harvest to come. Maybe there's been planting and watering, but it's full of weeds, and you need to cultivate it, and it'll take time. And we need to be discerning as we relate to people as to where that person is in that stage of development. And sometimes our evangelism is like people who try to hurry up the blooming of a rose by opening up the petals. We force it open, we think, there. We got the joking thing open. You can't force it. Jesus said, look, there are some who plant, there are some who water, and there are some who reap. Now, that person can be the same person all the way along. And what we found in Latin America is that that is the case. You start, you plant, you water, and eventually you're going to reap if you just keep at it. And the same thing holds true here. And the other observation that I want to make in just a parenthesis, then I'll go back to the point I was just making again, is that evangelism is never the work of the Lone Ranger. It's always a group activity. He talks in the plural here when it comes to bringing people to Christ. And that relates back to what we were talking about yesterday, where we have the witness of the body. And there are others who come in and assist you in bringing this person to Christ. And that's certainly the way it ought to be, isn't it? I'll never forget The first time I presented the gospel to a Brazilian, Osvaldo was his name, and he was curious because I had talked to his brother about Christ, and his brother was very interested, and he couldn't figure out how his brother could get involved in anything religious because he wasn't that kind of person. And Osvaldo was working in a factory as a chemist at the time, and so I had him over to the house for dinner, and he began to ask me questions about his brother and about what we were doing there in Brazil and all of that. And in Brazil, you don't have carpets on your floors, and you have wooden floors. And so I got out a piece of chalk, and I began to draw the bridge on the floor. And we spent 2 hours while I laid out with the Bible and with, you know, the diagram and everything, I laid out the gospel. And I showed him how, you know, there's a death side and a life side, and it was a beautiful presentation. And when I got all through, you know what his response was? He looked at it. He looked at me very puzzled. And he said, "Do you mean to tell me that is why you came to Brazil? To tell people that?" Well, that was kind of a letdown. I thought that was, you know, a pretty good deal. But he couldn't even see the significance of it. To him, it was a story that was irrelevant. And I realized right there that we were faced with a different set of problems than we'd ever faced before. And I don't know how it happened, but as we talked, I convinced him that he ought to examine the Bible with me. And he agreed. And so we began to go through the book of John. And we started out the same way that I described yesterday with Abraham. Started out in John 1, and I'd have him read. And one reason I had him read was because I couldn't yet in Portuguese. It was still a new language for me. And I'd ask questions, and I could get those questions prepared a little bit ahead of time, and so I could communicate. And so I'd ask questions, and he'd read. And he'd give me answers. Many times I didn't understand what he said in answer because my comprehension wasn't that good yet. And we went through John 1, John 2, John 3, John 4. And we met twice a week at least. And we would go from 7 o'clock until midnight. Well, finally, after 3.5 months of this, I could see that God is really working in his heart. And he became a Christian. But my experience with Osvaldo, and incidentally, Osvaldo is a missionary in Mexico right now. He couldn't see the significance of it. Now he's giving his life to it. But my experience with Osvaldo really set the pace for what we did from there on out. And what I learned from this is that if you just keep feeding a person, if you just keep feeding them, he's going to respond. And personally, I've never opened the Bible with a person like this, but what he has come to Christ. And I've never had a person come to Christ as we study the scriptures like this, but what he has gone on to maturity. Because you see, life is life. And when a person really meets Christ, something is going to happen. He's going to change, and he's going to continue. He's born. You know, I think one of the things that kills our communication with a non-Christian is this mentality that we've got to get him across the threshold now. Because Chicago will burn, or the rapture will come, or he'll be struck by a car if we don't save him right now. You know, I just don't think that's true. According to 2 Peter 3, God is holding up the flight for the stragglers. And if he sees that someone is coming along and responding, he'll wait. And that person will not be struck by a car or burned in a Chicago fire or anything else. until he gets in. And so, when you're studying the Bible with a person like this, you can relax. Because there'll always be a next time. You can go on tomorrow. And you can go on the next day. But see, when you begin to pressure and make the hard sell, that person has got to choose. He's either got to respond or back away from you, one of the two. And hard sell is for people who just do not believe in the Holy Spirit. You don't have to make the hard sell if you believe in the Holy Spirit, because He is a hard salesman. He will reprove the world of sin and of righteousness and of judgment. And I have seen guys toss and turn on their beds and tie their sheets in knots and in a rage say, "Okay, God, I will become a Christian. Just get off my back." See, we are not the ones to do the reproving. We are the ones, we are the boys who lead the horses to water and then they drink. That's our job. Okay, the fourth point is to just stick with him. You know, in Mark chapter 4, we have the parable of the sower. And it says the sower went out to sow. And he sowed on four kinds of soil. Some fell on hard ground, and the birds came along and ate it up. And some fell on stony ground, and it sprung up and looked pretty good for a while, but then died off. Some fell on ground that already had thistles and stuff growing, and it was choked after it grew up. And some fell on good ground. We know there are three stages in a decision, and I think this parable speaks to these three stages. When you make any decision, which is really for keeps, it involves your emotions, it involves your intellect, and it involves your will. The hard ground, hardness and indifference are the same thing. And the only kind of person that psychs me out is a person who just doesn't care. It can be a 94-pound girl who doesn't look like she has spunk or anything else, and she may be hard. It's because she's indifferent. And it says you throw seed on that and the birds come and eat it. And then it says there's the stony ground where it springs up, an emotional response. Man, that's what I want. But then under the heat of the sun, it dies off. And then there's the kind, the will, where it says the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, and the lust of other things, the will to have other things in your life, it comes up and it chokes it. But the good soil is where all of these three things are lined up. Let me illustrate it this way, how this works. Let's say a fellow meets a girl. He just sees her go by. And he just knocks his eyes out. He thinks, "Wow, I'd like to be married to her." And right then, he's emotionally ready to marry that girl. It takes him about 9 seconds to make that decision. But then he thinks, "Well, maybe she's stupid. Maybe she's selfish. Maybe," and he thinks about all the maybes. And he thinks, "Man, I've got to get some information." See, his intellect brings him back to sanity. And so he begins to go with her. And she isn't stupid. And she's not selfish. In fact, she is greater inside than she is outside. And he thinks, "Boy, I'd like to marry her." But then his will gets into the act and he says, "Look, are you willing to trade your suitcase and your duffel bag for a house and 9 tons of stuff?" And until that will gets his way, there's no marriage. And it's the same thing with Christ. You know, we're moved at the moment by an emotional appeal. And we make a decision. And the next morning we wake up and the intellect says, look, you really made a fool out of yourself yesterday, didn't you? The deal's off. Being emotionally stirred is not conversion. And being intellectually convinced that Jesus is the Christ and He is the only way does not make you a Christian. The least common denominator of salvation is Christ is Lord. There's a guy over in Europe who picked up some of these ideas about sowing heavily, taking your time, letting guys get into the scriptures and look at them, who began to do this as he developed the work in one of the European countries. And after about 3 months of this, he wrote to me and he says, Dear Jim, he says, I'm studying the Bible like this with six guys, and he says, they all understand the message, they believe it, but they're just too proud to accept it. As a matter of fact, they've just told me out loud that they're just not willing to respond to Christ. And so I'm ready to boot them. What do you think? And I wrote back and I said, Dear so-and-so, congratulations. You have finally gotten down to the real issue. For crying out loud, don't let up now. And today those six guys are the foundation of that work over there. When you are working with people, you have got to cover them like a rug. You have to know how their pulse beat is, what they're thinking, what's going on all the time. Stick with them. Be faithful to them. And that will come. Well, up to now, I have 3 minutes left. I have talked only about evangelism. This is a discipleship conference. But I think I can handle the subject of discipleship in one sentence. The sentence is this. It's just more of the same. That's all. It's just more of the same. The relationship is there. You're in the Bible together. You're giving yourself to Him. Your objective to that point was to bring Him to Christ. The only thing that changes is your objective. And what is the objective? That He learn what you know. That's all. That He become what you are. Just keep going. Well, I hope this all hasn't sounded complicated to you. I tried to make it simple. That's about all that can come out of a simple mind. Something that's simple. There's one little tool I think that would help you. This idea of using the Gospel of John to lead people to Christ has sort of evolved over the years. And Dan Green took it, and in this recent revision of the materials, he put this together in a Bible study form. And I don't know whether you have any around here or not, but you can get them from the Navigators. And if you look at it and read the instructions and so on and put it into practice, along with the things that we've talked about here, you'll be able to make it work. So you might want to try that.